Tonight and evening with Richard C. Hoagland from TheEnterpriseMission.com, author of the best-selling Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, soon to be in its updated edition as well, because there's more information coming all the time. I suspect that tonight's interview and chat with Richard C. Hoagland may go down as one of those classic nights, because in a moment, he's about ready to release a story that just might knock your socks off. So stand by. Okay, I could say he's a former Space Science Museum curator. I could say he's a former NASA consultant during the historic Apollo missions to the moon. I could say he was science advisor to Walter Cronkite in CBS News. I could also say that he continues to investigate some incredible stories, critically acclaimed independent analysis of possible intelligently designed artifacts, let's say on Mars, maybe the moon. I could say all those things, but I think I'd just rather introduce our friend and science advisor, head of TheEnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, for full show. Richard, how are you?
Hi there, George. That was a very clever introduction.
Unwritten, ad-lib totally.
Well, how long have we known each other?
A long time.
Two or three lifetimes?
A long time, my friend. How's everybody? How's Robin? And by the way, thank Robin for the introduction to Kevin Miller, who's now been on the show sporadically twice, but he's just an expert on these pharmaceutical drugs.
And I am looking forward to a show where they do it together with you.
We are planning something bigger than you can imagine.
Well, you know, this whole vaccination thing, which we're moving inexorably toward, I just listened to your first hour while I was prepping the post that I've got up on Enterprise Now, and it's really scary. If these trend curves continue, you know, there is pretty serious stuff up ahead. But fortunately, we have Coast, and we have this audience, and we have a mobilized electorate, and that's why I think it would be useful to consider her in the picture when you want to talk about vaccinations.
Absolutely. And we have you, Richard. And, you know, I think back at just all the wonderful programs that you have brought to this audience, from the Art Bell era to what I'm doing now, and you just keep thundering along for us, and I appreciate that.
Well, you know, we have some friends out there. In fact, we have a lot of friends. Technically, they're on Facebook. But we're getting a lot of leaks now, really interesting leaks on an extending curve that tell me that we're going to come to some interesting new breakpoints, nodal points. Points where stuff actually, you know, meets the road. And so what I want to do tonight is I want to use the next 3 hours to expand this audience's imagination and perception and projectability of the future. I want to really go outside the box. I want to speculate. I want to lay some foundation, some amazing facts which have just come to us, to Enterprise. And then I want to spend a lot of the program in terms of scenario playing. You know how the agencies, so-called alphabet agencies, work. They get a bunch of experts in a room, or these days they do it by email, and they basically speculate. They take the known database, and then they ask people deliberately to think of the most far-out scenario that they can conceive could happen. And then they run the permutations to see what the effects would be on the real world if those events came to pass. Well, we kind of do that here at Coast. You know, every night you do this in various disciplines. But I don't know whether a lot of people realize that what we're going to talk about tonight, just as much as monetary policy or health, you know, for enforced vaccinations for flu epidemics that are not real, that are chimerical, is as important to consider in terms of the areas that I cover, which is, you know, space and the impact of celestial mechanics and you know, the fiscal expenditures of the NASA budget and all that, as all these other areas, because those are the big picture items, the things that I'm talking about, that impact you in ways that you don't see, that are surreptitious, that are, if they're there, they make your life better. If they're not there, if we make policy decisions where they are deliberately withheld from, you know, the American people, then our life is going to be a lot poorer.
Absolutely. And it's, to me, Richard, It all seems to be around control, manipulation.
It's all about
broader
control.
Picture.
It is totally about control.
It truly
and,
is.
And tonight I'm going to raise the specter that it's about control of 6 billion people who, in the eyes of some people, have a drop-dead date, that they are perceived as superfluous beyond a certain point. And I will explain in some detail what I mean by that later in the evening.
Have your views changed over the years since you were working as a NASA consultant, working on the moon projects with Cronkite and CBS News? I got to believe that the Richard Hoagland of that era was, you know, accepting the towing the company line, grabbing the stories as they came, but you believed in things. You believed in the presentation of government. And I think as you've aged, or should I say matured.
It sounds like I'm wine.
Yeah.
I'm fine wine.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
That I think you've changed dramatically. I didn't know the Richard C. Hoagland from years ago, but I guess I've seen a metamorphosis with you just in 6 or 7 years.
Oh, that's interesting. And which direction do you think it's gone?
I think you have gone more in depth of not believing what's going on. Maybe it was Monuments of Mars that started things for you. I'm not sure. But I have seen you go from just a very open person to someone who is very suspicious now of organizations and groups. And I think that's healthy, but I've seen it in a dramatic way with you. Am I right?
Well, yeah, basically you're right. I mean, remember what Ben Franklin said to that woman outside Independence Hall in Philadelphia when they had signed they drafted and enacted the Constitution, ratified it?
I know it wasn't Don't Pull in the Kite. It wasn't that one.
No, she said, Mr. Franklin, what kind of a government do we have? And, you know, we don't know whether this is apocryphal or, in fact, it's an actual quote, but regardless, it's one heck of a statement. He says, Madam, a republic, if we can keep it.
And if we can keep it.
And the price of this republic, it's not a democracy. It's a republic for a really good reason, because ordinary people in their day-to-day lives do not have time to monitor all the skullduggery that's going on.
Wasn't it also Ben Franklin who said, we must all hang together,
or we will all hang separately? Yep. He was very good at that. he was a wordsmith. But, when I was young, when I was 23, I was talking to somebody the other day, and I was 23 when I, went with Cronkite. I mean, I knew nothing. I was this starry-eyed kid. You know, I grew up on the American dream, on everything that we're taught, you know, about the founding fathers and the country and where we're going and political figures and the fact that we were the last best hope of mankind. I think that's from Lincoln. And I still believe that. I still believe that this experiment in democracy, in Republican democracy, is the best thing going on the planet. The problem has been, it has been, as they say in the intelligence community, a captured program for too long. The country we now look at is not the country we should have, and it's not the country that I want to live in, or I want to, you know, swing its weight around on this planet. We need to get back closer to what the founders had in mind, but that requires a plugged-in electorate. That requires people who actually pay attention, and you can't pay attention to every detail. But you have to, as my grandmother used to say, if you don't know your furs, know your furrier. You can tell how old she was.
That is, because nobody buys furs anymore.
Well, it was pre-PETA, yes. But the point is that you have to put your trust in people who are worthy of your trust. And if your elected representatives are not doing what you want them to do, in this day and age where we are inundated with information 24/7, I mean, if I see one more frame of Michael Jackson's tribute, I am going to do something that I will not be held accountable for, because at the same time that that's going on in Los Angeles, the President of the United States is meeting with the President of the former Soviet Union, Russia, Medvedev.
Yep. Huge
and
story.
And the power behind the throne, Vladimir Putin. And the only place I could get in the last 24 hours a decent slice of what was going on the other side of the world in that critical set of meetings, you're not going to believe this, George, it was Fox. Everybody else was doing nothing but 24/7 Jackson.
I did not even mention the story today, the Jackson story. You know, we covered his death and we did those angles because it was a news story. But I said today, enough is enough. I think people want to just move on. And I think Elizabeth Taylor did it the best when she said, I'm not going there because I'm going to share my grief privately.
Yeah.
And that was probably the most telltaling,
well,
I think.
I don't want people to get the impression that I don't think Michael Jackson is worthy of some kind of tribute.
No, I know that.
Because I do, for a whole variety of reasons. I just think that what you're seeing, if you're an observer of media, like I have been ever since I worked with Cronkite, you are seeing the power of one story to blot out every other legitimate story that we should also be paying attention to in what's called parochially the news cycle. And if it's not Jackson, it's Palin. I mean, it's like we don't seem to be able in this society anymore to walk and chew gum at the same time, to borrow an ancient phrase. And we have to. We have got to be able to multitask. We have got to be able to do more than one thing at the same time. And I put this directly at the doorstep of the ratings greed, the fact that, you know, we have anchors sitting on television discussing with various other anchors the fact that if they try to deviate from the Jackson path in the last 12 days, their ratings plummeted. And, of course, the money guys say, well, you can't do that. You got to keep the ratings up. So we're basically in a money-driven, ratings-driven mania where we fixate on one thing and everything else goes by the board. And it's the everything else that's going to wind up, you know, doing us in unless we are paying really good attention, which, of course, is where the Internet comes in. Because it used to be, back in the days when I was with Walter, that we had three networks, right? If those three networks got co-opted by some major, let's say, social story as opposed to a nitty-gritty meat and potatoes, this is going to affect the fate of the American people story, you were really up a creek. But I cannot remember in those days, except for a few occasions, obviously the assassination of Kennedy was one such occasion. But that, of course, affected us all. That was not a celebrity story. That was not a social story. That was not an entertainment story. That had absolutely bare roots that affected the next 30, 40, 50 years from the time that he was killed. Now, fortunately, we have something called the Internet, and we've got Coast. Those two areas seem to be the only bastion where if you want an alternative perspective, if you want to dig beneath the surface, you know, as Cooper says on 360, you know, digging deeper, you got to do it yourself. And you and Art have done an extraordinary job with this audience in training this audience, and that means anybody who tunes in and wants to listen and pay attention, that you've got to dig beneath the surface of the story, and there are stories that are critically important to your future that you will never see on CNN or MSNBC or Fox for maybe 5 or 10 years. Eventually, stories that are on Coast appear in the so-called mainstream. But those who will listen to this show regularly know that we break things first and we dig deep and we bring you perspectives that you ever, never, ever hear until much later in the so-called mainstream network TV.
Next week is the 40th anniversary of Apollo 11. My, 40 years already.
God, you know, that means I'm that much older. Ah.
You were giving tubes to Marconi when he was putting them in the ring. You were small, I'll grant you that.
It
but you were still
Tesla,
giving him tubes.
It was not Marconi, it was Tesla. But why should we quibble? What I want to do tonight is I want to open people's ideas and imagination and perspectives to some things that are going on, but they're not aware they're going on because, you know, what's happened in the last 12 days has crowded out all real news, and then project into the future what will happen if we don't stand by and just allow these events to take place. Okay. And I think this is the perfect audience to try this little experiment tonight with.
And you have been working very, very diligently on what we call, well, I'm going to let you break it. I'm not going to say it. I want you to say it. You're the one who's been working on it. But I've got to tell you, I've been to conferences. People still keep talking about the data head that you showed us and the robot head. And I have a feeling you've got a few more tricks up your sleeve here, don't you?
Well, there is a sea change going on. My beat, as you know, is NASA and space and the synoptic impact that it's going to have on 6 billion plus human beings as we move through the next several years. You're right. At the conference in California, I showed you this amazing image that came from the Apollo missions, from Apollo 17.
Yep.
Of what looks to be an android, a robotic head, lying in a crater on the moon at the Apollo 17 landing site. And it stood the test of time. Nobody has been able to knock down the idea that that's what it really is. But, of course, the implications of that are staggering.
And we're not sure the astronauts who were there, the one who took the picture, even noticed it at the time, right?
Wayne Cernan and Harrison Schmitt, we do not know, A, whether they noticed it, although there was so much other junk in that crater that was sparkling, that was made of glass and metal and is not boulders and rocks. That you just can't imagine they didn't see it. Although wearing those gold visors did limit their ability to see certain things.
Okay.
And one kind of wonders if, well, one kind of wonders.
Right.
But the key question in my mind, you know, after I found this thing, and we found dozens of images, so there's no question that it was, you know, real and it was there and they took pictures of it. My big question is, did they, A, notice it, and B, did they bring it home?
It home, yes.
Because just let your imagination wander. What if Apollo, per Kennedy's instruction, which we can get into later tonight, what the real reason for Apollo was in terms of what I now think it was, what if they brought this back and they were able somehow over the last 40 years, give or take, to figure out a way to talk to it? If you had a surviving robotic memory on the moon, and it was created by a technology not that much in advance of our technology, it is not inconceivable that after even millions of years, if you brought it back and put it in a lab and connected it to the right power, et cetera, et cetera, You could literally read out the memory or establish a two-way conversation depending upon the sophistication of the robot in question. And obviously, if it was a functioning, autonomous robotic entity, it would be created in such a way that environmental extremes would have as minimal impact on its functioning as was possible with the technology of whatever year it was made.
And it could have been a camera head, so they may have been able to download pictures.
Well, remember, if it has eyes, it has incredible eyes that look like they are lenses. I mean,
yes, they look like lenses.
It looks like C-3PO's head lying on the moon.
Yes. As a matter of fact, one would think that George Lucas looked at that picture and decided to make C-3PO.
You know, I didn't want to really go there because that would take up a whole show in itself, but that scenario is actually not that far-fetched, George.
I know.
George Lucas is not the mild-mannered Hollywood producer that everybody thinks he is. And I have pretty interesting proof that he's a little more, and he's a little more plugged in than anybody might casually imagine.
Let's get your take on some of these missions back to the moon, unmanned. We'll be back. We played a little Frank Sinatra for you, Richard, a little while back, flying you to the moon.
I appreciate it.
What's going on with the moon these
days? We're in a very interesting confluence of events right now. As you said, next week is the 40th anniversary, oh my gosh, of the Apollo 11 landing on the evening of July 20th, 1969. 40 years since that extraordinary event took place. Now, as you know, there has been a tremendous controversy, which has gotten kind of louder and louder over the years, from a certain noisy contingent claiming that this never even happened, that the whole thing's a hoax, that NASA made it up. Well, as those who have read Dark Mission, my New York Times bestseller with Mike Barra, know, and those who have not read it yet but will be reading it after tonight will find out, we document in Dark Mission that NASA itself is probably the originator of the "we never went to the moon" hoax.
Why?
That is an entire evening which we are going to have.
Don't drop these little monsters on me and not tell me.
The reason is very simple. If you look at the population of a country in terms of demographics, in terms of, coin a term here, a bell curve, then most of the population is in the middle of the curve, meaning most of the population believes what the government tells them. They believe what they see on CNN. They believe what they hear in church on Sunday morning.
Yep.
They believe what their rabbi tells them. They believe what their neighbors tell them. They believe what their family. In other words, people, most people believe. They don't ask questions because they don't have time to ask questions. They're too busy staying alive, making a living, and sending their kids to college and making car payments and house payments and credit card payments and all that. Well, many, many years ago when I was at JPL, I noticed something absolutely bizarre going on. This was back when I was for CBS covering the lunar missions. And I was there representing, you know, Walter and the whole CBS crew. And it was the afternoon, I think it was the afternoon before the astronauts, the Apollo 11 astronauts, who were coming back from the moon. It's an incredible, extraordinary, unbelievable journey that we'd all watched on live television. They were about to splash down in the Pacific Ocean about a day and a half from the time that I got to JPL, because we had moved our broadcast facilities from Downey, California, which is where North American Rockwell, which had built the major part of the Apollo spacecraft, had their factory. We had moved our transmitting facilities and our vans and remote crew and everything from there up to the mountains, up to the San Gabriel Mountains to Pasadena, because NASA also had scheduled, because of celestial mechanics, an unmanned set of flybys of Mars that same week, Mariner 6 and Mariner 7. So we moved our broadcast facilities up there to continue the coverage of the manned mission, the incredible, successful Apollo 11 coming home, and the yet-to-be-decided success of the unmanned Mars probes that were flying by later that same week.
Okay.
So I walk in, and there was the usual bedlam, you know, a million reporters trying to get press passes and press releases and desks and typewriters.
A zoo.
Just close your eyes and you can imagine the bedlam. And I noticed this one guy prowling around the Von Karman Auditorium wearing, for one thing, it was a brilliant sunny summer afternoon, you know, July, I think it was 23rd, maybe 24th, something like that. And he's prowling around the chairs, the empty chairs in the auditorium, and he's taking something out of a little rucksack that he's carrying, and he's putting something on each chair. And that's not the most unusual thing. The most unusual thing was he was wearing what looked like one of those great coats, those long, floppy coats that cowboys used to wear in those 1800s films.
Yeah.
And it was completely out of place because it was hot. It was summer. It was summer in July in California. Even though we had air conditioning inside, it still was warm. So I'm watching this guy, and I kind of, you know, noticed that he then met on the far side of the auditorium with the head of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory Public Affairs Office, who then took him, his name was Frank Bristow, by the way, took him and escorted him to the press area outside the auditorium where all the high-end reporters had their desks and their faxes, or actually in those days we didn't have faxes, we had telex machines and phones and typewriters. Remember typewriters, George?
I've still got one. Don't use it, but I still have.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to just keep it.
I remember my first typewriter. Anyway, so I kind of followed them out at some distance to see what's going on, because I was really curious. What was this guy doing wearing this heavy, heavy trench coat? It was a light color. I think it was beige or cream or something. So it really stood out, but it was totally out of character for A, where he was, and B, the weather. So I'm watching as Frank is introducing this guy to all the major reporters for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, you know, NBC, ABC, Jules Bergman of ABC. Back in those days, I'm trying to think who was covering for NBC. It'll come to me. Was it
Richard Valeriani?
No, it may have been Hugh Downs in those days. Hugh was a really, you know, he still is. He's a great space guy. So they would have him cover all the space stuff in the early part of the coverage of the moon program. And, of course, Walter was not there yet because this was the afternoon. It wasn't the evening, and, you know, things were not going to happen for another day and a half. Or I think we had a special schedule for that night, but, the actual production crew had not shown up yet for that. So I'm watching as Frank Bristow, official representative of NASA, by way of JPL, head of public affairs, is introducing this guy around to, you know, Walter Sullivan of the New York Times and the L.A. Times science editor and the San Francisco Chronicle, Dave Perlman. Yeah, I mean, these are people that I lived with, literally, for years doing these various missions. And I obviously couldn't stand apart, so I kind of edged my way into this group to see what was going on. And sure enough, the guy hands me the same thing he was handing to all the other reporters and putting on the chairs in the auditorium. And it was a little mimeoed pamphlet. I think it had two pages, and it was folded over. Remember mimeo machines? Mimeograph?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, even before Xerox. I mean, we're talking Stone Age stuff here. And inside was a Mylar, that was the high-tech part, a Mylar American flag, which was printed in weird colors. You know, the stripes were aluminum, because Mylar is basically aluminized plastic. And then the stripes were yellow. They weren't red. And the field of stars was I think, Mylar with holes cut in it so that you could hold up the light and see the stars through the background.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of mnemonic device. That was designed to hook you so that you, like, you know, monkeys reaching out for shiny things, you would pick this up and you'd hold it and you'd start looking at it. Well, we all did. And the pamphlet, this two-page mimeoed, I mean, it wasn't even Xerox, it was mimeo, basically described that NASA had just pulled off the biggest hoax in history because Apollo 11 had been shot on a soundstage in Nevada, and the astronauts were being, you know, wheeled by truck or bus or something to the celebration when they were brought back to the United States in Houston. And I remember looking at this in my hand and finding the nearest wastebasket and just tossing it because there was so much other stuff going on. There was crew coming in. There was lighting. There was, you know, telecom checks. I mean, if you're getting ready for a live broadcast with a network, you don't have a lot of time to just sit around and kind of read things. It wasn't until literally decades later, George, that, you know, when I got into what I've gotten into and realized that NASA lies, that as my intel friends have told me over the years, the lie is different at every level, which kind of became the mantra for Dark Mission.
And by the way, was it Jay Barbree, NBC?
Jay Barbree, NBC, yes.
Yep.
He was definitely one of the guys. What we would do, we had different people, you know, we had David Schoenbrunn at CBS. We had, I'm trying to remember the names, Bill Stout, who became a really good friend. He's no longer with us, but he was the
great
chief
report.
Correspondent in the L.A. Bureau for CBS. When Walter was not there, you know, the second and the third tier would basically cover the moment-to-moment-to-moment parts of the mission. It was Jay Barbree for NBC at that time, among many, including Hugh Downs. As I look back, I said to myself, I mean, this was years later when I realized that NASA does lie. I asked myself, kind of, wait a minute, what was this guy doing, handing out a pamphlet to all the world's press, because everybody who was anybody was there covering Apollo 11 for this incredible historic event that it was. And even more important, as I look back in hindsight, what was he doing being squired around by the head of JPL Public Affairs for NASA? And I now, of course, know, and I answered my own question in Dark Mission. It was to plant the meme, M-E-M-E, the memory device that would then hook into people's consciousness at the appropriate time and build a rising crescendo of people, the people who ask questions, the people who may be suspicious, the people who are suspect, the government doesn't talk to them straight, that doesn't tell them the truth, starting with NASA and spreading out. And the idea was to co-opt those people into, I'll hit it right on the head, a fake conspiracy that NASA never went to the moon, to supplant among those questioning people, which is a percentage on the right-hand side of that bell curve, of all the people that would never question anything government did, certainly in those days, so that the real conspiracy, which is what we found on the moon, what NASA and the astronauts discovered and brought back, would never see the light of day. That's the reason, George. It's to supplant one conspiracy for the real conspiracy. And I was there when it was born.
It's a shell game.
It's a shell game. And what I'm hoping is that by putting this in the book, that some of the reporters, because we had like 1,500 to 2,000 reporters, everybody from the New York Times to the Pasadena Shopping News, okay? I'm hoping that somebody within the sound of my voice saved that pamphlet and that little, you know, Mylar flag.
Yeah.
And has kept it in a file somewhere for history. You know, some history buff who said someday this could become important, or just this was what was going on at the time. And that by making enough noise about this, I can get someone to come forward who has saved this in a file, because, of course, mine disappeared in the wastebasket in the next few seconds.
Sure.
Because I thought it was nuts. I was 23, and I thought it was nuts then, and I think it's still nuts now. And now I know why it was nuts. But the fact is that he was being shepherded around and introduced by the head of NASA Public Affairs, and you don't have that happen unless it's a plot by NASA.
Maybe it's also why Wernher von Braun has said, be wary of a false flag that will have to do, let's say, with UFOs. Just be ready for something like that. Didn't he say that to his aide, Carol Rosen?
He said that to Carol, who I've known for years and years and years, long before this came to light. And I remember when Carol told me that the first time, and I had met von Braun through her, and I had actually spent some time with him and his daughter and Arthur Clark and Phil Chapman and a few other interesting people at JPL in 71 with the first orbiting of the first American Mars probe, Mariner 9, to go into orbit around Mars in November of that year. So, yeah, von Braun, as we now know in hindsight, knew a lot more than he let on. And in his waning days, as he was dying of cancer, he tried to warn everyone of some kind of plan, some kind of plot, some kind of, I'll hit it on the head again, conspiracy, to get the American people and the world to think one thing when, in fact, something else would be going on.
That's genius.
Well, it's also
it is genius.
Preserving your historical heritage if you care about your credibility. And it was almost with his last dying breath. And now, of course, we understand technologically what he meant and why he could have warned about that. Because as you know, and as will be appearing in the revised edition of Dark Mission, which I have just finished and sent off to the publisher 2 days ago, an extraordinary set of updates and revisions to the book, which is going to make everybody who's got the original edition, I'm sorry, guys, you've got to go out and get the new one, because what you're going to read in the update is unbelievable. But unless you hold it in your hands and you read it and you look at the photographs, you're not going to remember. You're not going to believe what it is that you're going to see. We now have, in essence, a smoking gun that proves that NASA has been lying about many, many things for over 40 years.
Has that led you to make conclusions, for example, of the lunar dome model, for example?
Yes. What we have now had leaked to us in the last week or two by way of the current unmanned missions going back. I mean, the last NASA mission, manned mission, was in December of 72. It was Cernan.
That we know of.
Well, you always have to calibrate, you know, that we know of.
Sure.
In terms of the rocket technology, the Saturn V technology, the clunky, you spit stuff out the back and it pushes you forward technology, which is what rockets are. I mean, there's no way you could launch large-scale rocket investigations of any place in the solar system with anybody on Earth already knowing about it because of, you know, global satellites and reconnaissance and the Internet and all that. But if you have anti-gravity, if you have a real space program, if you have put to a technology the physics that von Braun himself discovered the night he launched the first satellite, Explorer 1, in January of 1958, if you have that technology you've been quietly working on and developing and refining and perfecting and producing in large quantities, then in essence, yes, you can have a secret space program that would have none of the flash and flame and smoke and fury and thunder and attention-getting events around it that the so-called public program does. And, yeah, you could launch that from an island in the South Pacific. You could launch it from the Antarctic. You could launch it from the middle of Siberia. You could have whole bases in the middle of Australia where you come and go to the moon, to Mars, and to the outer solar system, and no one would ever know except for the defense satellites in orbit around the Earth of many countries, mainly us, the Soviet Union, ergo now Russia, and of course China. And what did we see happen recently, George, with regard to DOD space data and the civilian scientific community?
Well, as we know, they have said, we're not going to release our satellite information anymore.
And the question, of course, before the House is why this sudden change in policy after 15 years of pretty openly sharing good stuff. I, by the way, sent you an update this afternoon on that story.
I have it.
Which, yeah, we can get to in a little while. It turns out it's a little more interesting than even we thought a couple, 3 weeks ago. But if you read that story, let me see. How do I want to do this? Do you want me to give you my impression or do you want to give me your impression first?
Of why?
Of what they say in the news story, what Leonard David found out in terms of what they're now doing.
Well, I still think it's the original story,
and that is exactly. That
they're hiding information.
And what they say in the update, what they told Leonard, was that they were going to look at the data and make sure that only non-security information was shared with the civilian community, which basically means they're going to have a screener.
Yes.
They're going to look at the good stuff, the stuff they don't want anybody to see, and they're going to pick and choose, cherry pick is the term, and give only that data to the scientists that will fit the natural bolide impacting objects from space model, which is what these scientists were upset that they weren't going to get anymore anyway. The good stuff, the stuff that I think they now want to keep secret, which is, you know, flying saucers, homegrown flying saucers made by human beings on this planet, zipping around in near-Earth space, that's the kind of data we're never supposed to get to see, ergo, from the confirmations of the secret space program.
Maybe Ed Grimsley is right with what he sees with his night vision goggles. We'll talk with Richard C. Hoagland more about this in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, do you subscribe to the old theory that perhaps mankind went to the moon millions of years ago with advanced technology that we have since lost?
Well, it's not an old theory. It's our theory. What we're looking at in the solar system, all the stuff that NASA hasn't told us about is our stuff, our ancient, ancient, ancient stuff. And if you look at that and really begin to understand the implications, which are pretty astonishing and off the edge of the paper, it makes sense now that the people who we're supposed to be trusting and paying attention to, and they're supposed to be giving us the data that our tax dollars are paying for, they're keeping it to themselves because they believe they are the appropriate stewards or inheritors. Or what's that legal term for when you have a legacy and you're the one that's supposed to get it? And the rest of us aren't. They believe, these people who have been doing this, and I'm more and more convinced of this now, they believe they have a God-given right, almost like the divine right of kings, to look at that stuff as their stuff, and the rest of us don't count. And you asked at the top of the show if I have evolved in my perception of this whole situation. Yeah, I mean, originally I thought we were dealing with a lot of very dumb people who could look at this data and not see what's obviously blatantly, plainly visible, you know, plain as day on these images and on the files and in terms of what's now been posted on the web. But no, it is a conscientious, consistent, deliberate campaign, a policy to keep the good stuff for themselves, and we pay for it, and they get to use it, benefit from it, understand it, research it, go back, exploit it. Does this sound vaguely familiar in terms of other things going on in our culture right now?
Almost everything, right?
Yeah. I mean, where are the trillions of dollars that we're giving to these banks going? Well, they at least have the guts to say, none of your damn business. NASA pretends to be on our side. And when I say NASA, remember, I'm not talking about 99% of the rank and file of the 18,000 employees of NASA who are left after the 500,000 of the so-called Apollo years. I'm talking about leadership. I'm talking about the people who pull the strings, the people at the top, the people who set policy, the people who claim to do one thing and are doing another. I mean, I'm really getting ticked off by this because it's gone on and on and on. And in the area I know exquisitely well, I can show you the lies that have been told consistently now over the last 40 years. I mean, this anniversary coming up, I'm having very, very mixed feelings. Because on the one hand, I think back to those halcyon days when Cronkite and, you know, Bill and all the other guys that I work with covered this astonishing human achievement.
It was also Frank McGee for NBC.
Frank McGee was for NBC. Yeah. What do you got, a whole list of guys there? You're going to poke them out all night?
As people send them to me, I'm passing them on to you.
Well, let's not miss anybody then, folks. Keep sending those cards and letters to George. But, you know, I'm really kind of conflicted because I know now that the program that we covered was a lie, an out-and-out blatant lie planned from the beginning to be a lie, to be a version of the truth but not the truth. And the conflict comes in when we're approaching this anniversary, and I see a story a couple of days ago in, I think it was the Sunday Express in London, that NASA had suddenly, miraculously, just a few days before the 40th anniversary, George, guess what?
What?
They found the missing Apollo 11 videotape.
Exactly. We talked about that. It was unbelievable.
Isn't it? Now, look,
we've been talking about this for years, haven't we?
Well, we broke the story. We broke the story on Coast that they were missing. And then we tried to get some people to write email Mike Griffin. And then we reported on this program that there was a consistent campaign in headquarters to keep him from seeing the emails. The NASA administrator, the guy that President Bush had appointed to be head of his space agency, was being kept from the people who were basically asking him, where are the damn tapes? So now we fast forward the film, and just a few days before the 40th anniversary, these original versions of the black and white video that we all saw 40 years ago, the evening of July 20th, have been found, and NASA is kind of being very circumspect about what they plan to do, but the word is that there's going to be some kind of a major showing around the anniversary, like, oh, didn't this happen just in time? Now, on the plus side, the quality of what we're going to see is going to be really impressive. You're going to finally be able to really see the astronauts, the lunar module, the lunar surface, the sun, the reflections, the shadows, the equipment they're putting up. You know, Aldrin testing his center of gravity in 1/6 lunar gravity, that kind of thing. The downside is they've had God knows how many years with advancing computer technology to expunge any interesting anomaly in the background from these videos so that it will conform with the NASA pre-sold version of what the moon is supposed to be about.
Well, of course, they're not going to let those things out without examining them.
I'm talking more than examining. I'm talking sanitation. I'm talking expunging. I'm talking, you know, you'd never recognize the moon that's really there based on these videos, but they will be purported to be the original, pristine, oh, look what we found in the vault down in Australia where they've been gathering dust for 40 years.
Hmm.
The other thing that is going to happen is that one of the two unmanned missions that were just launched a couple weeks ago, called LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, has now been put into its almost final mapping orbit. It's moving between 100 and some miles and I think 30 miles above the moon right now. And they're obviously going to be taking high-quality, incredible resolution images from orbit looking down of the Apollo 11 landing site. And they will then make those photographs available, and you will see, finally, after all these years, proof from NASA that indeed we did land on the moon.
Of course, what will the skeptics say who don't believe we went to the moon?
Well,
Photoshop,
that,
right?
That contingent, that group of people that were kind of looked at to be the ones that were dangerous because they might ask questions, they've already been bought and paid for with the fake conspiracy. Nothing you could do would convince those people, they remind me of certain other political groups, that we ever really went to the moon. No matter what evidence is provided, they are mostly locked up in the fake conspiracy, while they've been completely derailed from investigating the real conspiracy, which is what did Neil and Buzz really see that required those videotapes to go missing for 40 years until the computer technology was developed where they could be sanitized safely with no flaw, no fingerprints.
Interesting. But you're right. The Bart Sobrels will never be convinced that we went to the moon.
So where are we? Well, we stand at a crossroads because the one unknown factor in this entire equation is the election of Barack Obama. Now, I know you and I are having increasing differences on his presidency, even only 167 days in.
Well, I don't like the economic stimulus programs. I think that all this is going to bite us sooner than later.
Yeah,
so that's my major issue. That's my major issue.
That everything is as it's represented.
True.
And as we know, certainly you and I know from this show, very few things are as represented. So I'm willing to wait and see how this plays out for another, let's say, 6 months. I mean, a year is a fairly good measure of where an administration is really going these days.
I'm also baffled at how, like, WorldNet Daily, which has done some great stories and some other off-the-wall things, just keeps pounding away at this birth certificate story,
yeah.
And the other media really doesn't even touch it. Whether he's got one or not, it's not the case right now. It's the fact that you've got people now signing petitions, Richard, that want to get to the bottom of this.
Well, I think in the fullness of time, that will all be very interestingly resolved. And I have a private theory as to what's really going on. But it's kind of a distraction from this evening, so...
Right, yeah, and we don't have time for that. That's not the issue.
We have limited time.
Go ahead.
Well, the positive thing about Obama, which I want to call everybody's attention, again, looking at it from my perspective, covering the NASA waterfront, the space frontier, the things that are really going to affect the fate of civilization, is what he has done with NASA. Because what did he do? What was interesting to me during the transition is that when Obama was elected, and then you have this interminable wait until the president actually takes office, which these days is really crazy. I mean, why we don't do this on a more expedited time scale? It used to be, remember back before 1933, the president was elected in March. He was elected in November, but he wasn't inaugurated until March. It was FDR that moved it up to January 20th. Well, now, even, you know, November, December, January, that's an eternity. That's a lifetime. You remember the old cliche that, you know, a day is a lifetime in politics?
Absolutely.
Well, at the rate at which the world is moving, the rate at which we're all interconnected, the rate at which the economies propagate the stock market bad news around the world, from Tokyo to New York to London, et cetera, you can't have this three-month wait between electing a new administration and the new administration taking office. So what we saw was, during the transition, we saw a kind of a really expedited transition to where we kind of had, for a while, like they have in Russia now, we had two presidents. We had George Bush acknowledging the new president and really making things as smooth as possible in a way that was said by many observers to be unprecedented in terms of moving the new people in and the old people out and all that. Well, as part of that transition, remember how smooth it went in every department, every agency of this incredibly vast and complicated government,
yes,
the most complicated government on the planet. What was the one agency where Obama had problems?
NASA.
Exactly. And what was it that Mike Griffin, head of NASA, appointed by Bush, did that made me certainly go, oh, this is intriguing? He told Obama's official representative, a gal named Lori Garver, who has now been nominated by the president to be the deputy NASA administrator, but who was head of Obama's NASA transition team, he basically told her she wasn't smart enough to evaluate his, i.e., Griffin's, space program. Remember that?
Yeah, I do. I do remember that.
Okay.
Kind of arrogant, wasn't it?
It was incredibly. And particularly, you know, it was also impolitic. Forget the arrogance. But here's a guy whose wife simultaneously, I'm talking about Griffin now, was campaigning, sending emails to a bunch of very influential congressmen and senators who ultimately have to approve of the new administrator, campaigning within the aerospace community to have her husband, Mike Griffin, kept on as the NASA administrator. Now, that's not going to happen when you basically kick in a delicate part of the anatomy the president's official, you know, envoy and tell her that she's not smart enough to basically darn your socks. So what was his game? What was the agenda? It was almost like he was flagging that NASA was something the president should pay attention to. Remember, nothing is as it appears on the surface. The lie is different at every level. And when you see a smart guy, I mean, Griffin has 5 degrees, right?
He's
been around NASA and politics for most of his professional life. Do you really think that's how he thought a guy who wants to continue to be administrator should comport himself with the new president?
But you never trusted him from the get-go.
Well, I was, you know, I'm back to Reagan, you know, trust but verify. I was willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. Remember, early on, I said he made some really smart decisions, like saving Voyager. Remember that?
I remember that.
And he did several other things, like he reinstated the Hubble rescue mission, which turned, I mean, talk about gold. That telescope is a brand new 21st century space telescope because Mike Griffin said, overturning Sean O'Keefe, no, we're going to go and fix it. And he stuck with it, and he made it happen, and he produced a shuttle that was reasonably safe so the astronauts could go up and do that and not get killed. And it all worked, and he absolutely deserves 100% credit for those important decisions. The dumb thing he did, the amazingly weird dumb thing he did, was championing the so-called Constellation program, spending $6.5 billion on the Ares new rocket to replace the shuttle, which doesn't have a prayer of really flying because it's got so many problems and it's so over budget and behind schedule, and it has left us now with a five-year gap between the time the shuttle program is supposed to end, which is next year, according to President Bush's schedule, and the time that the new spacecraft and the new boosters to continue the manned space effort or the human space effort is going to go into orbit, which will not be until 2015. A five-year gap where the only way we're going to be able to get to our own space station is by bumming a ride with Putin. I'm sorry, with Medvedev.
Well, yeah, but even, you know, you just made the same faux pas that the president
did. It's because everybody, and I have a funny story to tell you. Well, let me tell the story now.
Couple minutes, go ahead.
What's very interesting is, you know, a few days ago, before our president, President Obama, went to Moscow, I was suddenly invited by this major Moscow magazine published by TASS, which is the official Russian news agency, remember?
The Russians like you for some reason.
They wanted me to do an op-ed piece, which is going to appear. It was supposed to appear before Obama arrived. I was informed tonight that it will appear next week as a kind of a perspective on the meeting between the two presidents and the prime minister, Putin. And they've asked me now to add to my op-ed piece, which is really interesting. Why is it interesting? Because I believe that Obama's attention was called specifically to NASA as a problem child in the transition by Griffin as a strategy, that he knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew that it would get attention, and he wants the new president to focus on what's going on in NASA, because the NASA that he hands off is not the NASA that he wanted to hand off. That, in fact, the entire Ares Constellation debacle has been something he was forced to do, but in fact may not have wanted to do if he'd had complete discretion. Nothing else makes sense. So what does Obama do when he finally gets the message? He appoints a special blue ribbon presidential commission, the Norm Augustine Commission, to hold hearings and to do in-depth studies and research and report back to the president by early August, that's like a month away, on the state of the human spaceflight program and his Constellation, the best way to go back to the moon and on to Mars. And Obama had bit the bullet, and in all the agencies, the only one where he's having a major top-to-bottom review is the one that is the most important for the future of mankind, NASA.
Back in a moment. And we're back with Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, what's your take on Ed Grimsley, Mr. Night Vision Goggles himself?
Well, I have a first-person witness, as you know, someone whom I trust in terms of her judgment and perceptions and all that. We kind of talked about her at the top of the show. Her name is Dr. Robin Falkov. And she, last year at the Tesla conference, which I'm going to get back to in a second, actually looked through Grimsley's $3,000-plus, you know, infrared night vision.
Third generation,
and saw strange stuff. She also saw some things without the goggles, which was even more intriguing to me. But you've actually seen the same thing.
Yes.
Used the goggles.
I've seen two very bizarre things that night.
Yep. The thing is that if there is a secret space program, if NASA and the other programs that we see on the planet, the Chinese, the Russians, the Japanese, the Indians, everybody doing this stuff with rockets, if we're kind of like the second tier. You know, we're not the first string. We're the folks that have to kind of plod along and do it with Newtonian physics, because the real physics has been deliberately kept from us. I mean, to me, this is what this seems to be shaping up to be in terms of a ultimate reality. that we almost have, and this is going to be an interesting idea I want to explore in the next hour and a half. It's almost like that civilization, George, has bifurcated, that we have split into those of us that have been confined to Earth, except for these little primitive, you know, puking little rocket thingies that they let us play with. Ah, you're laughing.
Yes, I'm chuckling.
And then there's the guys that have all the cool stuff, the HD physics, the anti-grav technology, the unlimited free energy, the pollutionless power, the endless materials, the diamonds as cheap as sawdust. Those people really have a separate civilization. Remember, I told you I wanted to think outside the box tonight.
Yep.
And they are running their own show, and they kind of occasionally allow us to play in their sandbox. You know, they let us send these little probes to Venus or to the moon or to Saturn and send back these pretty pictures, and they let the scientists play at their little games, you know, analyzing stuff. Whereas, in fact, there are human beings wearing extraordinary spacesuits walking on the moons of Saturn, looking into the incredible crevices of Iapetus, reading the ancient libraries of human beings who were fantabulous millennia, thousands of millennia, millions of millennia ago, and we are not supposed to know anything that this is going on. That is the model that I want to present for consideration, as Rod Serling would say, for your consideration in the Twilight Zone.
Ingo Swann, father of modern-day remote viewing, claims that he saw structures on the backside of the moon in a remote viewing session.
Yes. Oh, isn't that a great segue?
Go ahead.
Because something is not quite right with the plan. They just launched these two new missions called LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and LaCrosse, LCROSS, on the same rocket. And they have kind of dualistic and complementary missions. LRO, as I said a few minutes ago, has gone into orbit now and is going to be in a position in the next few days to take the first high-resolution views of the Apollo 11 and all the other Apollo landing sites and the Ranger crashes and the Russian probes and all the other stuff that's been placed up there in the last 50 years by various nations. And they are going to probably release some pretty interesting imagery showing that, in fact, there is a descent stage of the lunar module. There are backpacks. They won't be able to see the flag. It's too small. But they will probably be able to see the lunar module with even the shadows of the legs sitting there where Buzz and Neil left on that morning, the morning after the night before when they had landed on July 20th on the moon. That timing of all this happening right now is really interesting because the second mission of the LRO kind of compendium, the LaCrosse side of it, as you know, is supposed to put a spacecraft, a 5,000-pound rocket booster called a Centaur, controlled by this little LaCrosse shepherding spacecraft to which it's still attached, into this very elongated orbit such that in about 4 months, in October of this year, actually after the new revised edition of Dark Mission goes to print and comes out, you know, on the front tables at various bookstores, that spacecraft, LaCrosse, is going to impact the moon in a very dynamic, and they're telling us, maybe even visible from Earth event.
So around October 9th or so.
October 9th, the morning of October 9th. In fact, it's going to be 4:30 in the morning your time in Los Angeles when this thing hits.
Okay.
And what we're going to do when we get closer is, you know, I will come on and I will instruct this audience how they can go out with their own telescopes and set them up and look literally from probably the Mississippi River west, because that's where it's going to be dark still, and they will actually maybe be able to see this with a telescope. Under a very interesting scenario, they may even be able to see it with the naked eye, and we'll get to that in a minute. The precursor to this was the fact that the LaCrosse mission, which is this kind of separate piggyback mission on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter launch the other day, went to the moon and did a duck under the South Pole and got flung into this very elongated orbit, which is a 38-day orbit. It takes 38 days for it to go around the Earth once, and it will go around once, twice, three times, and on the fourth time, they'll smack it into one of these sunless craters near the south pole of the moon, ostensibly looking for ice, looking for water which has frozen in the bottom of that crater and has not seen the light of day for literally, as Carl would say, billions and billions of years. And that water, if they find it, will be the absolute life's blood of the project to return to the moon and set up a base and to begin a true solar system civilization. But it's not being done with HD technology and physics and anti-gravity and all that. It's going to be done with rockets. It's going to be done in the conventional, slow, plodding way. Now, when the spacecraft, La Crosse, ducked under the moon a few nights ago in the wee hours of June 23rd, they were calibrating the cameras and the instruments on board. We have posted tonight on the Enterprise Mission website, enterprisemission.com, which I was able to get up there just before airtime, a part one of a couple-part paper that I'm going to write over the next day or so. So you got to come back after you read part one. You got to come back for part two. Because what the La Crosse team, which is based out of NASA Ames near San Francisco on the West Coast, appears to have done is they appear to have leaked the first bona fide official NASA evidence of ancient structures on the moon.
This is incredible. Plus, I've got to tell you, your buddy Jerry Purnell, the science fiction writer and science writer, just sent me an email, and he just wanted you to know that he had one of those mimeograph sheets with the flag in it.
Did he keep it?
No. He said it's gone.
Oh, damn, Jerry.
He said it's long gone.
Oh.
He's been listening to the show, and he says, Richard's an old friend, and maybe he's got it right.
But he remembers it.
He remembers it.
Well, I have a witness then.
Yes. Well, and it's Jerry Purnell.
I mean, Jerry and I go back, God, even before Marconi.
He'd be glad to know that.
No, that's amazing that Jerry remembered, because he was one of the hordes that descended on JPL to cover the mission. Well, Jerry has a network. I mean, everybody now is connected through Facebook.
Oh, Jerry has a great network,
yeah,
by the way.
So what we need, Jerry, if you're listening,
we need for you to find,
maybe Larry Niven preserved his. You know, somebody preserved that little mimeo thing, because there was the genesis of this stupid lie that we never went to the moon. And it would be so nice to nail this up on the wall and write fini to that nonsense, and to look at the real conspiracy, which is what NASA now has leaked. Now, here's what's gone down. After that early, early morning pass under the moon, La Crosse was moving away from the moon into this very elongated orbit. You can see all these diagrams on the EnterpriseMission.com website. They looked back, and they took about an hour's worth of data. Ultraviolet, infrared, visible light, spectrometers, you know, calibrating the instruments with the real moon. What this instrumentation is going to be used for in October is they're going to zoom in really close, following about 50,000 miles behind the Centaur rocket, which they cut free. The rocket slams into the moon at almost 2 miles per second. And then the La Crosse spacecraft, the so-called shepherding spacecraft, which is loaded with all these instruments, is watching and recording and transmitting back to Earth in real time the data of the huge plume of dirt and dust and maybe ice kicked up from the bottom of one of these shadowed craters.
Will this be a bigger plume than the Japanese craft that hit?
Yes. Okay. Because it's a much heavier spacecraft. And the kinetic energy goes up as the square of velocity, and this thing is coming in excess of the escape velocity of the moon, whereas the Selene Japanese spacecraft was in orbit around the moon. It's also going to be an almost vertical dive between 70 and 80 degrees, which is a whisker away from 90, directly into the moon. So all the facets of the mission are maximized for the maximum bang for the buck.
Alfred Weber thinks we're bombing it.
Alfred Weber is nuts. I'm going to say it coast to coast. Alfred Weber is nuts. But he provided a very interesting scenario that seems to be a variant of something that I'm going to propose tonight that's going to make Weber's scenario look like a Sunday school picnic.
And you call him nuts?
Wait till you hear what I have to say.
Before we jump on you, huh?
So the LaCrosse spacecraft is following about 50,000 miles behind the Centaur empty rocket stage. The rocket stage slams into the moon, kicks up in their model a plume of dirt and material from the moon, you know, surface from this, yeah, this sunless crater, maybe 10 miles high. All that material sees sunlight for the first time in God knows how many millions or billions of years. It vaporizes. The instrumentation on LaCrosse detects it, detects the water, which is what they're really looking for, because water on the moon costs, I mean, what's the most expensive mineral water that you can buy anywhere on Earth, George? All neatly packaged in a crystal bottle and everything?
It costs Evian and everything else.
Yeah,
it
all costs. All right. I actually went out and looked. The most expensive bottle of water you can get costs between $40 and $50, okay, for a pound of water in a little bottle.
That's a lot of money.
Water on the moon will cost $50,000 per pound if we have to import it from Earth with stupid rockets to build a lunar base. So if you find water on the moon, if you find water at the North Pole or the South Pole of the moon in these permanently shadowed craters, you have drastically, dramatically, incredibly sliced by factors of thousands the cost of establishing human beings in some kind of a outpost on the moon.
And we know they have found uranium there.
Yeah, that's kind of useful further down the road. Actually, yeah. You want to go solar energy. You don't want to go nukes on the moon for a whole bunch of reasons, but that's another show. So anyway, the LaCrosse spacecraft is following along, and in 4 minutes, it impacts the moon. It's a kamikaze mission, but not before it has sent in real time the data, this priceless, precious data, back to Earth, back to Ames, back to the scientists and the technicians and the computers and the whole NASA network, and also all the ground-based observatories that will be looking and recording with their spectrometers aimed at this point on the moon, including Hubble. The refurbished Hubble is really going to come into its own with this mission, because if we find the water that they're expecting, it dramatically and totally changes the price of going into space in every imaginable direction if, and this is a big if, you are limited to clunky, primitive rockets. Because water on the moon can be made into rocket fuel. And
is
that
there,
rocket fuel will take you anywhere.
Well, you know, Zubrin has said this in the past with regards to Mars.
Yes.
If we can terraform Mars one day, can we do that to the moon or not?
Well, yeah, of course. If you have the materials, you live off the land. I mean, this is axiomatic. I mean, Lewis and Clark did not carry...
But can we create a true atmosphere on the
moon?
You
don't need to. You build domes. Duh. That's why they built the domes in the first place, George.
I know. Would you want to live in a dome?
Well, it depends on the size of the dome. Remember, a dome on the moon, you know, right, is if it's big enough, you can actually fly with human muscle power. You can strap wings on your arms, and you can fly on the moon.
I watched them build a domed stadium here in St. Louis years ago for the football team, for the Rams that we got from L.A. It took years and equipment and people. How are they going to build this stuff on a far-off land?
Well, don't think 19th century. Think 21st. It'll be done with nanotechnology, little computer-controlled robots, things that automatically chew up moon dirt and spit out glass and form it and shape it, and it'll all be done by robotic remote control. You won't need one Mohawk, you know, to build the high-rises on the moon as you have had build them in New York and Chicago and elsewhere on Earth.
And I guess we'll be sending pods up there, too, and they just hook them together?
Well, you mean for living spaces?
Yeah.
Well, initially, but ultimately you'll basically be mining the moon. Now, remember, this is in the NASA standard scenario. in the enterprise scenario, there's a huge amount of already manufactured stuff that can be, you know, you simply plug it in and turn on the lights and bingo, you've got instant civilization, which, of course, is the reality. All of this is pretense. Remember, the NASA you think you have is not the NASA that really exists. It's a false front Western town. It's to keep us all occupied, thinking this is how we explore and inhabit and colonize space, where the real space program, the secret program, which we will talk at great length about in future shows with more evidence, it God knows where it could be tonight. You could have human beings with outposts on Pluto, for God's sake, waving at NASA's Horizon spacecraft as it flies by in 10 years. That's the disparity between what we get to see and what they don't let us see. And I know that Jerry and others and I participated in endless meetings about private space programs. Oh, we need to get NASA out of the game. We need to get private industry, you know, like you know, Elon Musk now and Bert Rutan and those guys. But remember, those guys themselves are not talking about anything really interesting and big. They're talking about mucking around the edges of the new ocean, as Kennedy called it, in Earth orbit, where we have been doing precisely nothing for 40 years. We closed down going to the moon, George. Why did we stop going to the moon?
Well, we never know. Some say because we were told.
Well, my bet is because they couldn't. Look, if you have enough missions, at some point the secret's going to slip. Not everybody can be bought. Not everybody can be paid off. Not everybody can be brought into the club. At some point, some credible person will scavenge the evidence, will hold a news conference, and the game is up.
And be a whistleblower.
A big one.
As now, the FAA just said, by the way, last week, that most of the whistleblowers that the FAA didn't say it, but it came out of an investigation. Most of the FAA whistleblowers were telling the truth. The FAA never did anything about it.
Interesting. What,
so it's probably the same in NASA and every other agency.
Look, this is what your first guest in the first hour was talking about. The trend curve is really bad unless there is a game changer. There needs to be a stunning global game changer. Why do you think, George, that I have stayed on the pursuit of ancient extraterrestrial civilizations for decade after decade after decade? Don't you think I could make $1 million? Don't you think I could write 15 novelettes or novels?
Oh, sure, but that and I know you're not a millionaire. That I know. I'll be back in a moment. Let's talk about these ancient civilizations. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Richard, just to make sure I understand this, too, when you talk about ancient structures and civilizations on the moon and the Mars, are you saying the ETs did it or we did it at some time?
No, we're the ETs.
We are the ETs.
Yeah, okay. Remember, aliens have a different DNA. ETs, it's a matter of real estate. ETs visiting Earth now, unless you specifically say they're aliens, they're human beings. They're part of the human family. That's the big secret that they don't want us to know. Human being. That was the whole reason that Neil Armstrong said exactly what he said. And then we've had all these fights all these years about the missing A. What was his first phrase as he put his boot on the lunar surface?
That's one small step.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. And they all said, oh, he left out the A, which would make it personal, right?
Mm-hmm.
No. If you read Dark Mission, if you read the entire panoply of evidence we put together, Mike and I spent a lot of time putting this together, that which is at the end of the book is explained in the following manner. One small step for man. Human beings on this planet are mankind, all right? The one small step for man applies only to the people who live on Earth. One giant leap for mankind is everybody else who's out there who's related, genetically related, because we're an ancient race, and we've been a lot of places that they don't want us to know about. Our history has been stolen from us deliberately with malice of forethought. This is what got John Kennedy killed. He was trying, as you know from the historical record, to share the Apollo missions with the Russians, for God's sake. And 10 days after Khrushchev agreed, they killed Kennedy. Now we have an American president in Moscow visiting with a Russian president and the Russian prime minister, and this magazine asked me to basically create an op-ed which would craft things that they could do together, that we and the Russians could do together. So what did I write about? I wrote about Kennedy and Khrushchev, and that we should go back to that idea, doing big, huge things together for the benefit of all mankind. The economic, extraordinary economic impetus that alone would provide the world economy, would provide for enough wealth to make all 6 billion people on this planet have the kind of lifestyle that most of them can only dream about. And if they all got it with current technology, they would kill the planet. They would smother it in coal dust and oil fumes and all the other pollutants that we have been, you know, spewing out for decade after decade after decade. The real technology, the technology that these guys have in a back room, which they say they would rather give up a major American city to nuclear terrorism than come out with. That was told to me by an intel agent face-to-face as recently as 2 days ago. That kind of technology is all ours because it comes from the stuff we used to do, the heritage of all mankind. And we have not been allowed for 40 years to get in touch with that technology until this past week, which brings me back to the lacrosse mission. Because if you go to enterprisemission.com and you click on the first banner, NASA's smoking gun, and it will take you to the article I posted earlier tonight, which is part one of maybe two or three parts. I know it's going to be at least two parts. At the bottom of that post, you will find a set of images, infrared images, thermal infrared images that basically record heat radiation. They differentiate in false color between hot and cold stuff. The cold stuff is blue and the hot stuff is red. And they photographed the moon with the lacrosse instruments going away that night when they did the loop-de-loop around it in preparation for the impact in October. And they then released on the official NASA Ames website this amazing infrared image, which if you look at it and you read the post carefully, and then you come back in a few hours or a day or so and you read part two, I will describe exactly why this is an incredible leak of extraordinary importance, because all a physicist who knows about thermal imaging, infrared photography, or imagery has to do is take a look at that picture, and he will instantly know exactly what he's looking at, and it does not bear any resemblance to the natural moon that NASA has tried to sell us for these 40 years.
Looks like a power source.
Well, what it is it's thermally heated by the sun, right?
Right.
It's a sphere. You're looking at a sphere in space.
This in the side that's red, obviously, is pointing toward the sun.
Toward the sun, and the side that's blue is coldest. That's where it's dawn on the moon.
All right.
Remember, the temperatures on the moon vary between 250 below zero at night to about 250 above zero during the daytime. So you have a 500 degree Fahrenheit spread of temperature.
What am I missing? So what's unusual
about
this?
Okay, look at the edge of that infrared image.
About on the red side?
On the red side. What do you see all along the horizon?
Well, on the red part.
Yeah.
I see something that looks like the red spot on Jupiter.
That's the Moscow Sea. This is on the far side of the moon. That was photographed by the Russians in 1959 by Zond 3. You can see it on the left comparison, which is the visible light image.
All right, yeah, I just scrolled down a little bit more and saw that.
Okay, yeah, you need to go down to the next one, yeah, the comparison. Now, what does it show as that curving line along the horizon?
A dome.
What color is that line?
The line is yellow.
Yeah, it should be red.
The whole thing should be
red. The red part should go to the horizon. The only physical explanation, other than they screwed up the photograph, which, by the way, they did not, and that will be described in part two, the intricate hoops they've jumped through now to try to take back this image, which got leaked out on the official lacrosse website the very night it was taken. And if you look carefully at the raw image, you'll see it's a screen grab from a computer screen with a handheld digital camera that's slightly out of focus.
Do you know how big this dome would have to be?
That's irrelevant. God, it's funny because one of my intel guys was looking at this and he was giving me the same argument. But Dick, it's too big.
If you're you can't build it that big.
But you can. You can. And I don't have time tonight, in the precious time we have remaining, to go into the all the whys and wherefores why this is totally, totally physically possible with known physics. I mean, Frank Lloyd Wright, remember the brilliant architect?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Wanted to build with steel and concrete on Earth a skyscraper in Chicago 1 mile high in the 1930s, back when skyscrapers were all the rage. With 1930s technology, he was proposing, and it could have been done if they had enough money, to build a skyscraper 1 mile high. Do you know the height of the highest skyscraper on Earth today?
It's not a mile high, that's
for sure.
It's
about a fifth of a mile. Yeah, it's a little over, let's say, 1,500 feet, okay? On the moon, because you're dealing with 1/6 gravity, everything could be 6 times bigger for the same structural strength, okay?
Who built this dome?
I don't know. My great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. It wasn't us. It was our great ancestors, if I'm right about the model. And again, we're not going to know this until we go there and find the libraries, which, of course, NASA's had 40 years to do.
Tell me about the Moscow Sea, though. What is that?
The Moscow
Sea.
Moscow Sea is a...
That red spot.
Remember, look at the comparison. It's dark like a Mare on the visible side of the moon.
Right.
And we now know from the Apollo missions that the visible Mare are composed of lavas that appear to be highly rich in titanium and iron and other things. They are the foundations, George, of the ancient, now smashed cities that used to be under the domes. The structures on the near side of the moon really got wiped out in the war, the ancient, ancient war. The stuff on the far side of the moon is in better shape. It's better preserved. That's why the two sides look so radically different. Lacrosse took this infrared image and is looking at the domes edge on against black space, right? So if you have a dome that's heated by the sun and it's the same temperature as the ground underneath, it should have the same color in terms of the false color image, correct? But if you're
sure.
looking at it sideways against space and it's got lots of holes in it, it's going to have what's called a lesser optical depth, meaning it's more transparent. It's ragged. It's really like Swiss cheese. So the sensor, the camera, the infrared camera, is going to be recording simultaneously the heat from the dome as well as the heat or the lack of heat from space itself. Now, the difference gives you the yellow color, which is an intermediate temperature between the blue of the Terminator, which is dawn, which is really, really, really cold, 200 below zero, and the high noon sun directly overhead red part at the edge of the moon you can see in that photograph.
When you first saw this dome.
I was dumbfounded. And I showed it. By the way, you know who's here tonight?
Yes.
Hold on.
I'm going to remote view.
Okay.
Oh, Robin, of course, is there.
Robin is back, yes.
And you have a guest there.
We have a guest. If the guest will pick up.
Female.
Female, very good.
Speaks Italian.
Speaks very fluent Italian.
Paola Harris.
Paola Harris is here.
Now, how did I know that?
Because Robin sent you an IM. Sorry, guys, it isn't ESP. It's Internet.
She's been sending them all night, critiquing.
I know. She's great that way, yes. I have to look at the archive. Anyway, the point is, Paula looked at this and was dumbfounded at two levels. One is by what it means, and the other was by how the hell did you get it? And then I explained to her, as I was working on putting this thing up tonight, politically how we got it. It wasn't through some back channel. This was posted, George, as the official NASA image, infrared image, from the Lacrosse flyby of the moon 4 or 5 nights ago on the 23rd. Now, what is interesting is the next day, Ames had pulled down this version and had replaced it with a closer cropped version which doesn't show the edge of the moon and the temperature differential. Then further, they've now tweaked it and they've got another version up there, and all of this backstory will be detailed in part two. But I wanted to get this thing up tonight so people, particularly people who know people who are scientists, who are physicists, I mean, this is a very, very high-end technology. It's commercially available. It's being used by FEMA and Homeland Security and all kinds of agencies to take infrared thermal imagery for security and all that. And the photograph was stunning.
It is weird. I'll tell you that.
It's wonderfully weird. It's the beginning of the end of the cover-up. How can I say that? Because several weeks ago, someone else sent me imagery from Mars, which, if you are intrigued with this, that imagery will really blow your socks away because it shows unquestionably, unequivocally, buildings and structures and warehouses and apartments and whatever you want to call them. We have no idea what they are, but they're absolutely unequivocally architecture, and they're on Mars, and we've now found the source data in the NASA files, and this will all be explained in Dark Mission, in the revision, which, if we're lucky, will be out in print in the bookstores before the Lacrosse impact on the moon the night of the 9th of October.
How do you get this material? Do they email it to you, or do you get it in some envelope?
Some comes in the mail, some comes over the transom, sometimes. I mean, I literally had one guy some years ago drive from Kirtland Air Force Base and drive up to the front door when we lived at the other house and drop off a packet at the front door as a courier.
And did he run after that?
He left. He hightailed it out of the driveway before I could get, you know, to the front door to find out who it was.
It's like a baby in a bassinet, huh?
Exactly, except it was a set of discs. And it was from the Russians. It was from the Russian space program, from Mars.
Interesting.
Anyway, to close the loop on this, for those people who are here in Albuquerque, in the next couple of weeks, on August 1, on Saturday evening, the 1st of August, I was invited this afternoon to present at the Extraordinary Technology Conference, the annual Tesla Technology Conference here in Albuquerque held every year. I was invited by the administrator, by the coordinator, by the promoter, producer, to give a two-hour presentation on Saturday evening at the Nativo Lodge, which is where the conference is being held this year here in Albuquerque, literally just down the street. I'm going to show for the people that show up, and we'll put the links on the website. I didn't have time tonight to put the links up. I do have a phone number for people that want to call and reserve space now, because believe me, they only can hold about 200 people, and they're going to go like hotcakes.
That's so, it?
200 people in the auditorium for me to show this data. I'm going to show the lunar data, and by then we will have something from the Apollo 11 anniversary, and then I'm going to show some of this incredible Mars data where you can unequivocally see the buildings.
Last time I was with you at a conference, you had to move to a bigger room.
We may have to move to
you
a bigger
room.
You remember
that?
I remember vividly. It happens a lot, George. Anyway, the number, if you want to call up for the folks that don't have computers, it's area code 520-463-1994 for tickets.
520 or 502?
520.
All right.
463-1994. I'll have the link up later tonight or tomorrow on Enterprise for those people who are computer, you know, in the conversation via computer. But there's a lot of people in this audience that don't have computers, and they still use phones. So 520-463-1994. I'm going to show things that are unbelievable, and we're calling the presentation the smoking gun. You know the standard cliche, the one piece of evidence that proves the case beyond doubt. When people see this data after 25 to 30 years I've been on this trail, I mean, you asked before, why have I kept doing this? It's because the payoff at the end is a totally transformed planet and global civilization. Of all of us guys and gals who have been kept in the dark because a handful of people believe this is not ours to know, ours to benefit from, ours to profit by, or ours to use to remake civilization in a form that will be humane for every human being on planet Earth.
Richard, when we come back, I want to talk about your NBC sci-fi production of 2012.
Okay.
And then we'll also take some phone calls. Everybody's lining up to talk with you. Our guest tonight has been Richard C. Hoagland. His websites, let me give them to you. If you're driving around, I'll make it easy for you. EnterpriseMission.com, DarkMission.net, and, of course, you know, I was... presented to Richard many, many years ago when he popped up on a cable station talking about Monuments of Mars, and I was mesmerized ever since. We'll be back with your phone calls and Richard C. Hoagland next on Coast to Coast AM. Airing on November 13th, by the way, is NBC Sci-Fi's production of 2012, of which Richard C. Hoagland has been a consulting producer. Richard, any updates on the program?
Well, we're in production, or I should say post-production. All the shooting has basically been done, and now there's the infernal job of putting it all together for 2 hours, minus commercials, where it makes sense.
Yes.
I mean, how do you talk about the end of the world in a way that makes sense? For the possible
Not easy.
End of the world.
Not easy.
For the end of the world that can be canceled because of rain. No, people are going to see things in November that they have never seen on television, national television before. They're going to see people and a structure of evidence and data that is pretty mind-boggling, and I'm hoping it's only part one of a multi-part series. At least that's what we've been discussing, and it all depends on how our producer, who, of course, by the way, wanted me to say hello to you. She really had a good time with you guys when you did your interviews out there.
Right.
How well she can capture this material and break it down for television, which is the name of the game.
Well, we look forward to this. And at what point do you think we get a little clip we can pop on the website?
I will ask Tom, not our Tom, but another Tom, who is actually the customer, when we can do that. And they're very interested, of course, in the Coast audience, because the Coast audience really helped make the Crystal Skull special a smashing success, pun intended. And I have great hopes that this one will be even more in that vein, because this is basically part of what the hidden agenda is about. The Mayan calendar is synced so specifically to the Gregorian calendar that, as you're going to see in the show, that is probably not accidental. And there's a paper trail that demonstrates how it was done. That being said, it means that some people in authority, in the power structure, going back at least 500 years, George, half a millennium, have been looking in Western civilization toward what happens on December 21, 2012. The moon stuff, the Mars stuff, the who we are stuff, it's all part of the big stuff. It's like you really get the feeling. You remember when George Gobel used to appear on The Tonight Show?
Oh, it was classic.
And it was classic. And one night he came on, and Frank Sinatra was on, Dean Martin was there, Sammy Davis Jr., Johnny, of course. I mean, it was an incredible. And he walked in and he looked around, he sat down on the couch, and he looked at Johnny and he deadpanned perfectly. He said, "Do you ever get the feeling some days that you're that life is a wedding and you're a pair of brown shoes?" It was so cool. Well, we have been kept out, meaning all of us, except for these little guys who think they're the elites, who think they have the right bloodline, who think they are special, that they own this stuff and we don't have a say. They've been getting away with it for hundreds and hundreds of years, as you're going to see in the 2012 special at the beginning of well, actually, more toward the middle of November. It's connected. It's all part of a larger tapestry. That's the one thing, George, that you do on this show that nobody else in any media market anywhere ever does. They do not connect dots. They do not present. These are pieces of a larger reality, and when you get the hang of it, you can see how much you're missing and what you got to do to get your life back, to get your future back, to get your past back. Because without a past, we don't have a future.
So true. Let's go to Kurt, driving around in San Francisco in his truck. Hey, Kurt.
Thank you so much. I had a quick question. Do you think the lacrosse mission finding ice is more of a cover-up to actually try to get inside the moon?
You know, Kirk, you are definitely an A student. let me give you the Hoagland variant on the Weber scenario. I'm really suspicious of Alfred Weber, and I'm going to hit it right on the head, because what Alfred Weber is doing is trying to keep lacrosse from happening. He wants enough people to rise up and say to NASA, oh, you can't do that to the moon, like
right.
Creating a little crater, which is 68 feet across and 15 feet deep, is really going to matter? I mean, look at the moon with a telescope some night, guys.
It's all craters.
There are 30-plus thousand craters. This place has been bombarded for billions and billions of years, and this little Centaur rocket is not going to do anything in terms of what's there, except to reveal what's there. Now, I don't know whether we have the time. We've got about 20 minutes minus, I guess, the end. But I wanted to lay out one final really bizarre scenario. If there has been, coming off your question, if there has been a hidden agenda for, let's say, just since Apollo, the last 40 years, there's been a group going to the moon with anti-grav technology and all the incredible toys that we can only dream about, and that the NASA that we see has been kind of stuck in the mud because it was deliberately politically kept stuck in the mud so we wouldn't go anywhere and go anywhere near the moon and kind of interfere with what was really going on with this other group. Now, George, you've got all these other nations going back, right? You've got China. You've got Japan. You've got Putin. You've got Russia. You've got Russia going with India. You've got the Europeans. You've got George Bush saying, oh, we got to go back to the moon, right? So suddenly everyone's going to the moon, a place that we're all told is a dead, cold orb with nothing of interest and no reason to ever go back ever again. Correct?
That's what they say.
What if there has been a secret base on the moon in one of these sunless craters, mining the ice, doing all the things that we've talked about doing, and they've been there for 40 years?
It would be pretty advanced right now, wouldn't it?
But they can't let the world know that that's what they've been doing. How would you get rid of such a facility in a way that would have total plausible deniability?
Well, assuming your astronauts were safe and back home?
Exactly.
You'd bomb it.
You'd blow it up.
Yep.
What's one more crater on the moon, right? And what if you were using lacrosse as the visible excuse, and when it impacts the nukes, which, because they would have to use nukes to vaporize all the technology, right? What if they trigger it simultaneously so that everybody looking at the moon that night will see this astonishing, stunning, visible eruption from the south pole of the moon, and NASA will say, oh, we must have hit a gas pocket.
Let's go to Chicago, wildcard line. Hello, Elizabeth.
I can hear you smiling.
Yes,
hi, George.
I am.
Hi, Richard.
Hi there.
Richard, what you are up to is very similar to what Timothy Leary was into in the mid-70s. My parents were friends of his, so we heard him a couple of times on his lecturing circuit. And he was speaking about what he referred to as SMILE. It's an acronym standing for Space Migration, Intelligence Increase, Life Extension.
Mm-hmm.
And the life extension part didn't really work out because he was a smoker and he had a bad diet. But
exactly.
Some of the parallels, just even the question that George asked you about, well, how would you go out about making, producing this dome? Somebody actually asked him that, and he had the exact same response that you had. Now, there was another question.
I actually met Tim Leary a couple of times. had a couple of conferences before he died, and he was an incredibly interesting guy. I mean, he was a really interesting guy to talk to.
Of course, yeah.
But this, of course, this was in the dark age. This was in the 70s before this became kind of percolating down to where we can talk about it in polite company tonight and not be thought to be totally off the wall.
Well, he was interesting. There was something that he was asked, and actually I'd like to hear your response to it.
Okay.
And see how similar it would be. Not that it has to be. There's this concept that here we are on this planet with virtually everything offered to us on a silver platter. We have air that is the right combination of oxygen and nitrogen. We have our water. We have our soil with the rain for growing crops. We have our fuels to keep warm. And even though we've made a mess of the planet, which was sort of his argument, who wants to stay here and die? Let's, migrate. Still, we will be the same idiots who try to reproduce the air, the water, the soil, the crops, and that sort of thing. We'll be the same idiot people who will go there and try to do that under a dome and basically transport everything up there. He didn't answer the question about how really practical and realistic that was. So it's something I was curious, how would you respond to that?
Well, let me break your question down into two parts. The part that Leary got wrong is this is not about migrating. This is not about leaving. This is about saving Earth. This is about saving 6 billion human beings who, if we don't do this, if we don't inhabit the solar system and use the resources out there that are, our God-given right, we are going to die. Just look at the future projection of the history of Earth. We're going to have more and more people fighting over less and less stuff with better and better weapons, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to project that curve to where it ends, and it ends in our destruction, our mutual 6 billion people destruction. What's the way out of the box? My friend Kraft Ericke, who was a genius ahead of his time, basically had the appropriate analogy. He says, you do not make a fire in your house by burning the furniture in your living room. You bring in trees and put them in the fireplace. In other words, things in their appropriate place. Pollution belongs in space, not on Earth. Industrial capacity belongs in space, not on Earth. Pollutant chemicals, nasty things you don't want to get anywhere near but are necessary to produce products, they belong in space, not here on Earth. The Earth is the only natural biosphere that we know in the entire solar system. The first mission of any serious space migration is to preserve planet Earth, to use all the technology and all the tricks and all the knowledge and all the energy that are out there to basically restore the Earth to as pristine an environment as is possible with a high a living standard for more people than you can imagine that is possible with the minimal impact on the environment as is possible. Once you look at that equation in that way, the idea of including space as part of the economic infrastructure of human beings as we move further into the 21st century and the 22nd and the 23rd makes absolute rational sense, and anything else is stupidity to the nth degree because it's too many people chasing too few goods for too little gain for too many, and that's going to wind up in catastrophe. So I do not look at this as a leave the planet. I look at this as the way civilizations have always worked, which is those people who pioneer a frontier, they benefit the countries and the nations and the peoples that they leave behind, provided there is a pass-through back and forth. I mean, look at what Europe's situation was when the Pilgrims left. And look at how in the Marshall Plan it was the United States and the wealth that was created on the new frontier that literally has now created the most wealthy European society the planet has known in modern times. That did not happen by people staying home. It happened by people leaving and coming back and enriching everyone. That's a scenario that I see can be repeated again, except this time there are no Native Americans to kill. There's no genocide to commit. There's nothing to do but re-inherit what was ours from the beginning, which is out there just waiting for all of us.
Okay, let's take a call from Florence, Oregon. Hello, Mark. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, George. Good evening, Richard.
Good evening.
Sir, I want to thank both of you, sirs, actually, for such an interesting and informative show. Richard, you know, I know that between you and Art Bell, if I heard right, going back, I don't know, 7, 8 years when Art still had a show, I believe, before George took over the regular show, that I could tell by innuendo, so to speak, of the what was said between you, if someone was listening closely to what preceded that, it was just a quick remark that it's kind of humorous between you, but there was this idea that you really weren't welcome on Art's show to really, you know, go into hardly any detail at all about the idea of what you just mentioned a few minutes ago, which my original call centered around, but I do have a related question to that. You did answer it for me when you said that there is an elite who has, I believe, by implication at least, global control. And I was going to ask you in your research through the years in various subjects, Richard, you've obviously found the strands and the fiber and then the structure and then probably have come to the realization some time ago how pervasive in our reality the influence of this global elite is, because they do control the technology of the planet and they do have so much power on an economic level. But I wanted to ask you, Richard, two questions. One is...
We'll only get one in. Go ahead.
Okay. The Luciferian doctrine, as it applies to the spiritual beliefs and disciplines and experiences of these global elite that we agree do exist and have the most influence of by far, as they control our reality essentially by this point in time. Have you found this to be a reality? And... that would be very interesting to hear your answer. And God bless you, gentlemen, and thank you.
All right. Go ahead, Rich. You want to take a step?
Well, that's a very leading question and requires more than a yes or no answer. It requires, obviously, some real discussion. So I'd like to say that provisionally, yes, there are controllers. There are people who are trying to manage the affairs of Earth, of 6 billion people. My model now is that they're getting ready to kind of cut us loose, because our usefulness has come to an end. They have achieved, with this suppression of technology and science and understanding and history and heritage for at least 50 years and obviously a lot longer, they have achieved their objectives and they are about to embark on something new. There's definite indications. I mean, the election of Barack Obama is one such indication. Those people that we're talking about, who shall remain nameless, can you imagine for a minute that they would have allowed a black man to become president of the United States of America? Their entire philosophy is antithetical to the idea that the mongrels, you know, should inhabit or should inherit anything. So Obama's election, as I've been saying for months and months now, signals to me a very interesting turning point. I've been dealing in terms of the worst-case scenarios tonight. I obviously don't have time to go into the opposite, which is the best case scenario, but I can give you a little window, which is if Obama's election means what I think it might mean, then the reason we're having leaks out of NASA of stunning, physically measurable stuff, the reason that Dark Mission, you know, is going to reach a whole new level of the American space program, as I have heard from our Russian colleagues, it's being read and intently studied by the Russians in their space program, which is how this one reporter got onto us, we may be at the beginning of a new era, but it requires, as Ben Franklin said, a republic if we can keep it, which means we all have to be paying much better attention from here on.
Thank you, Richard. Richard C. Hoagland for Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.